From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we say farewell to Toni Morrison by revisiting the recent documentary about the acclaimed writer. Then, Brian Banks was falsely accused of rape. He hopes a movie about his life reveals what's broken in the criminal justice system.
This is what it is to be wrongfully convicted. This is what it is to be picked up off the street for something you didn't do, and by the time that they figured out that they made a mistake, 10 years of your life have passed.
And how has Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood managed to anger Bruce Lee's family? That's all coming up on The Frame. The acclaimed novelist Toni Morrison has died at the age of 88. She won Pulitzer and Nobel Prizes, and she was also awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. In the recent documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, we learn about the woman behind the work and her rise in American culture. The film, directed by photographer and filmmaker Timothy Greenfield Sanders, was released in theaters earlier this summer, and that's when film critic Biondrea July reviewed it for The Frame.
Toni Morrison's novels were always on my mother's bookshelves growing up, but until I saw the new documentary, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, I didn't know much about the woman who wrote them.
Even when I wrote The Bluest Eye, I was really writing a book I wanted to read. I hadn't seen a book in which black girls were center stage. I wanted to read a book that had no codes, no little notes explaining things to white people. And I had a major, major question in my mind at that time, which was, how does a child learn self-loathing?
The Bluest Eye is the story of Pacola Breedlove, a black girl who thinks having blue eyes will save her from the torment of her daily life. It was Morrison's first published novel, and it's the kind of serious and unflinching work that made it surprising for me to see how funny and carefree Morrison is in the movie. Like in this clip where she's talking about her college days at Howard University. It's the 1950s.
When I got to Howard, I was loose. It was lovely. I just loved it. I'm sure I overdid it, but I don't regret it now.
She's got an amazing sense of humor.
Farrah Jasmine Griffin is a Toni Morrison scholar.
She is one of the most down-to-earth people I know, and yet, you know, she's also genuinely a genius.
Griffin heads the African American and African Diaspora Studies Department at Columbia University. Griffin is interviewed in the film, but she also happens to be one of my favorite professors from when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania. So after seeing the documentary, I called her up.
The brilliance that we see on the page is always operating, and that those things aren't separate, you know, that they exist all in that one person, that you get that full range of who she is.
It's not that Toni Morrison gets super personal in the film. She really doesn't, actually. She keeps the focus on her public professional life. But director Timothy Greenfield Sanders still manages to maintain a sense of intimate storytelling. He matches the beats of Morrison's life with a stunning array of black visual art. And he wisely makes Morrison the narrator of her own story.
She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order. It's good, you know, when you got a woman who is a friend of your mind.
And while the film is an unapologetic celebration of Morrison, it also lets us know that her work wasn't always well received.
When you read early reviews of Toni's work, those early sympathetic liberal reviewers, and I remember one of them about Sula, and the reviewer says, she's got a great talent. One day she won't limit it to only writing about black people. Like, really, it's limiting for her to write about black people? Like, no one says that when, you know, an Irish writer writes about Irish people. You know, it's only limiting when you write about black people.
And when she published her novel Beloved in 1987, almost 50 prominent black writers, including Alice Walker and Maya Angelou, called out the literary establishment for not giving Morrison her due. Here's a clip of a journalist asking Morrison about that in the film.
What is your response? Because now you're sort of caught up in the middle of all of this.
It's easily the most significant thing that has ever happened to me in my writing life. I write out of the culture, as everyone does, for it, through it, and I'm in it. So a portion of that culture said to me, amen.
But even after Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993, the critiques didn't end. The documentary cites critics who said Beloved is a fraud and that the award was an act of political correctness. I looked up the source of these quotes, and to my surprise, they came from Black men, cultural critic Stanley Crouch and novelist Charles Johnson, respectively.
Those critiques said more about the people who made them than they said about Morrison's work, because there was no question in our minds about the literary importance and sophistication of her work. And, you know, these came from talented writers themselves, but it really did lend itself to turn a sort of lens on them and say, why? Why do you need to do this?
Going into the film, I knew that director Timothy Greenfield Sanders was a longtime friend of Morrison's, but he's also a white man. And it seems to me that the director clearly understood he needed Black women on his team to properly tell Morrison's story. Like the visual artist Micheline Thomas, she made an inventive custom collage from pictures of Morrison for the film's opening credits. And Greenfield Sanders also brought on producer Sandra Guzman to conduct the interviews. And composer Catherine Bostick wrote and performed an original song for the film.
Walk to the edge and dance with me. Walk to the edge and set yourself free above the water.
After watching the film, what stays with you is Morrison's undeniable presence. And of course, her intellectual brilliance lingers too. But it's precisely those pieces being gathered together that lets the film hit its mark. It's what makes you see that Morrison herself is that friend of my mind that she writes about. She's that friend for all of us. For The Frame, I'm Beyondria July.
The one-eyed man is king. Walk to the edge and dance with me. Walk to the edge and set yourself free.
Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am, will reopen in select theaters on August 16th. Coming up on The Frame, Tom Shadyac was Hollywood's top comedy director. Then a bike accident changed his entire attitude about life and the movie business.
Woke up this morning, put my feet on the clay.
A new movie opening Friday tells the true story of Brian Banks. He was one of the nation's best high school linebackers and hoped to play in the NFL. But in 2002, he was falsely accused of rape and spent almost 6 years behind bars. Banks also was required to register as a sex offender. With the help of attorneys from the California Innocence Project, Banks was exonerated in 2012. The movie about him is called Brian Banks, and it was shot in and around Memphis, Tennessee, 2 years ago. And that's where I met with the real Brian Banks. And he has some specific truths that he wants people to take away from the film that bears his name.
95% to 97% of all criminal cases in the United States ends in some form of a plea bargain. Only 3% to 5% of cases actually go to trial. So when you're sitting there at night, late night, watching Law and Order, dun-dun, you know, those are 3% to 5% of cases that only go to trial. Everybody else is pleading to some kind of deal. But that doesn't mean that 95% to 97% of people are guilty. It means they're being forced into deals, exhausted into deals, feared into deals. Our system is built on a plea bargain. The incentives, the perks, and the promotions that a district attorney receives from a high conviction rate is a problem. If we were to remove those rewards, if we were to remove those incentives, and if we were to enforce punishment for wrongful convictions, I bet a lot of that stuff will slow down.
It's unimaginable to think about what you went through, but you're having to relive it, because what this movie is doing is revisiting how bad evidence was admitted, how it was used to put you behind bars, the decision that you made at the point of a gun in terms of accepting a plea. What is it like to watch your life replayed? It's like, I don't want to see that. I can't go there. But you were on set watching this.
No, actually, absolutely. You know, there are parts of this film that while it's being filmed, I won't show up. I won't come in onto set that day. For example, the arrest scene when I was arrested at home, and my mother, I remember my mom, dropping to her knees and screaming as loud as she could and pleading to God to not let this happen, And so when they recreate scenes like that, there's no way I'd be close to it. But then there's a lot of other parts that, although are tough to be around for the purpose of authenticity and truthfulness and what really happened, I feel like it's my duty to be there, because at the end of the day, this movie is not only just for me or the California Innocence Project, but the many other people who have experienced wrongful accusation, wrongful conviction, or may experience it somewhere near in the future. And then it also gives people who have never experienced it or know nothing about this world to get a true and accurate POV of this is what it is to be wrongfully convicted. This is what it is to be picked up off the street for something you didn't do. And by the time that they figured out that they made a mistake, 10 years of your life have passed.
Ready. And. Let's go to other slide. And. Action.
For the film's director, Tom Shadyac, telling the Brian Banks story is a departure from the movies that defined his career. Once the most sought-after comedy director in Hollywood, he's known for films like Ace Ventura, Pet Detective with Jim Carrey, and Evan Almighty with Steve Carell. But after a bike accident left him with post-concussion syndrome, Shadyac re-evaluated his life. He sold his mansion, renounced materialism, and left Los Angeles for Memphis, where he has family. Here's Shadyac talking to the cast and crew on the set of the Brian Banks movie.
And so this is, I believe, where your generation can take the human species in the future, which is seeing our jobs, our careers as service industry to help uplift each other and thereby being uplifted ourselves. So with that said...
Under that mindset, Shadyac, who's making his first feature in 10 years, says that he's taken up projects that stray from his mostly comedy background.
Being a creative person who wants to stay involved and active, I started teaching, and I've been teaching for 11 years, and that drew me to Memphis. And I taught here, and I experienced the themes of these movies through the lives of my students. I saw kids arrested for being black. I saw the injustice that Brian experienced on maybe a more intense scale happen to my students, thrown in jail for crimes they didn't commit with no evidence and no resources to get the legal help that they needed to argue their case, to prove their innocence. And I could feel it in my heart. And when I read Brian's story, and as much or more when I met him, because Brian is the right microphone for this ideology, he went through an extraordinarily difficult shadow, but came out beaming like the sun. And I met him and knew that it was something that I wanted to be a part of, to try to bring this story to the world as emblematic of a larger issue in this country.
There are things that are parallel in my mind between what you went through and what Brian Banks went through, and I'm not going to compare them, but both of you had horrific things happen to you that were none of your own doings. Brian was unjustly accused of a crime he didn't commit and served multiple years in jail for that crime. You had a bike accident and suffered post-concussion syndrome. But both of you had what I will call an epiphany. You had a moment where you're able to kind of step outside of your lives and look at your lives in a new and different way and come out the other side with new direction, new focus, new perspective. Do you think that your lives, even though they're not identical, have some sort of mirrors in them, and that what happened to Brian spoke to you on a level beyond just filmmaker who sees a good story, that there was some connection beyond that?
Yes, I think there's a good, and I'm not likening what I've gone through to the deep pain that Brian's gone through, but yes, there's an absolute parallel, and not just with me and Brian, but you and Brian and everyone in Brian. It is the hero's journey. We face obstacles. Brian's was an intense obstacle of losing 5-10 years of his life, a chance to play professional football. And he turned that darkness when he was unjustly accused of a crime, and he's turned it into light. And that's the opportunity that we all have. And I hope when people see this movie that it's certainly not a prison movie. It's a movie about what you do when the worst thing happens to you. And we're hoping that people will see Brian's story and say, you know what, if he can survive that and even thrive through that, then I can make it through my difficulty as well.
There's no argument that Hollywood and people who work in Hollywood live in a bubble, but there is a bubble that you have escaped because Memphis is a particularly interesting city. It's unbelievably poor in many ways. So when you leave Hollywood and come to Memphis, how does it change the way you see not just the city, but the world? Because this is, for a lot of people in Hollywood, this is flyover country. Now that you're connected to the community and active in the community, how does it change the way in which you see the nation?
Well, first of all, I mean, as you described Memphis, there's more to Memphis, but it sounds like a great place to make art, for art to grow. Where do artists come from? They come from situations, families, difficulties, and from that dark soil, they grow a garden. In L.A., we drive by maybe a homeless person, but we never venture into entire neighborhoods that have been disenfranchised because there's a line between the west side of L.A. and the east side of L.A., and we very rarely cross that line. In Memphis, it's a checkerboard. You have to drive through neighborhoods where it's not just a homeless person. It's an entire neighborhood that has been left without resources or support for decades. It's generational. Now, either all those people are doing something wrong, or maybe something has happened in our culture that has left a whole population out of the vision of what we hope America can be. So, yeah, it's changed my perspective. It's evolved. I used to talk a lot about issues and difficulties and problems, and now I've been blessed to be inside of them.
I want to ask you this last question about values. This is something you write in Life's Operating Manual. I'm going to quote it now. No one worked harder than the caterers on Evan Almighty. They rose at 3 a.m. every morning to shop for us, cook for us, and feed us, but they were paid little in comparison to the stars, producers, and, well, me. The kitchen staff, I later found out, lived three or four to a room, as many could not afford a place to stay. But cooks are not paid handsomely, nor are ditch diggers or teachers or policemen or firefighters, because generally they don't grow businesses. Rather, our economy rewards the growers, because growth, right up there with greed, is good. But is it? So you ask the question, what's your answer to that question?
Well, I prefer it rhetorical at this moment. Well, it depends what you're growing. If you're growing more greed, I would say no, growth is not good. And I think we value every night on television this idolatry of magnitude. Oh, the stock market rose. Well, what does that mean? Oh, housing prices are up. Well, what does that mean for a person entering the housing market? And see, this is what I think we've missed in art. We begin to accumulate, and I'm this guy too. I mean, I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. There's no fingers pointed out that aren't pointed in. And then we lock ourselves behind gates. Right. And what turned us into artists, it's all the difficulties in our life are shut out now. We're behind gates and we atrophy. We atrophy as artists, but also as human beings. And I just think you got to keep diving in. It's not lean in. It's frickin' dive in.
Tom Shadyac, great to see you.
Thank you, brother.
Brian Banks opens in theaters on August 9th. Coming up on The Frame, martial arts legend Bruce Lee is portrayed in Quentin Tarantino's new film, and not everybody is happy about it. It's been 10 days since Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood arrived in theaters. It's generated about $80 million in box office receipts and sparked a little controversy. LA Times film writer Jen Yamato wrote about the movie's portrayal of the late martial arts star Bruce Lee. We'll hear from Jen in a minute, but first this scene in which Lee, played by Mike Mo, fights with Brad Pitt's character.
My hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight, I accidentally kill you. I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
So let's talk a little bit about what happens in this scene. Brad Pitt is playing a badass stuntman, and he encounters Bruce Lee on the set. And Cliff Booth, who is Brad Pitt's character, and Bruce Lee have a little fight. And let's just say that Brad Pitt gets the better of Bruce Lee. Fair enough?
I think that is exactly the crux of the argument here, is how people see the scene, starting from the very question, does Bruce Lee get beaten? And from there, whether or not you see it as they come to an even draw because it's best out of three and they get stopped before round three. Or if you sort of measure the degree to which Brad Pitt coolly getting knocked down and Bruce Lee being thrown so hard into a car that he leaves a dent are equal in measure, I think that is part, but not even the whole of the argument here.
Let's talk briefly about Bruce Lee and who he was and where he was in his movie career at that time. His landmark movie, Enter the Dragon, has not yet come out. Let's play a little clip from Enter the Dragon. It's basically a fight scene, and Bruce Lee is fighting a very tough guy and getting the best of him. So Bruce Lee is an incredible fighter, great martial arts star, and at this point in his career where the movie is unfolding, he's doing Green Hornet, right? He is Kato in the Green Hornet. So that's the coincidence of the encounter?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is set in 1969. And more specifically, it is set in this hazy, dreamy memory version of 1969 Hollywood that Tarantino remembers and is recreating, is representing. And the flashback that we see Bruce Lee in takes place on the set of Green Hornet, which only ran from 1966 to 67. So it is a flashback in time, temporally, within the world of this film. And at the time, Bruce Lee played Kato, the sidekick to the star, Green Hornet. And while it was certainly one of his most iconic early works, he was not appreciated at the time, and he didn't feel appreciated by Hollywood either. After the show ended, he had to leave Hollywood. He had to go overseas to become a star in Asia before being able to come back and get his flowers at home. And the tragedy of that is that Enter the Dragon didn't come out till after his untimely tragic death. But that also, I think, begs more consideration of why Tarantino is using this specific moment in Bruce Lee's career to bring him into the film.
There are so many different ways to look at this scene, but let's talk first about how Bruce Lee's family is viewing the scene. I think it's fair to say they're unhappy with it. What is the nature of their argument, and what do they feel is wrong about the scene and about the way that Bruce Lee is depicted?
Bruce Lee's family was not consulted ahead of time like Sharon Tate's family was, for example. And so I spoke with Shannon Lee, who's the daughter of Bruce Lee, after she had seen the film for herself opening weekend. And what she told me was that she found it very disrespectful, a caricature, not character, and not at all like what her father was. And I think a lot of fans of Bruce Lee agree with her. Now, then you get into the conversation of, is Bruce Lee in the film supposed to be depicted as he was, or is this subject to artistic license because this is a flashback or a dreamy flashback subject to the perspective of Brad Pitt's character?
What has Quentin Tarantino said, if anything, about what he was after in this scene?
Tarantino has not done a ton of interviews, period, about this movie. So he has not really spoken that much explaining this. Although when he was doing the press tour pre-release, he described it as a scene in which it's meant to show that Cliff has these killer capabilities, so to speak. I'm paraphrasing.
The other thing that I think was interesting in your article is that in audiences who are watching the scene, there's some laughter that feels almost as if it's directed at Bruce Lee, that there's some derision. And it's not just uncomfortable laughter, it feels almost mockery. Is that something that you have heard from people who have seen the movie?
Certainly. And I for this story in the LA Times, it was very important for me to get a diversity of opinion on this. I included perspectives from film critics and cultural critics about that scene, very specifically about that scene in the historical context of who was Bruce Lee and why did he mean so much to people that they might take offense. And what I have heard from many of the Asian Americans that I spoke to about the scene is that they felt uncomfortable. Many people felt uncomfortable in the theater hearing laughter from the audience around them that felt like it was laughter at Bruce Lee's expense. And that's where the reading that this is mockery comes in. That's where the reading that that the racial undertones inherent to the scene, even its premise, are, I think, worthy of deeper examination.
Jen Yamato is a film writer at the LA Times. She's the author of the article Bruce Lee's Family Calls Once Upon a Time a Mockery. Is it insult or homage? Jen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's the show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.